There we are. Very good. Okay. Right. Now, Acts 22. What we have in 22 through 25, actually, are several somewhat lengthy, and 26 as well, speeches by Paul before various tribunals in which he's offering an explanation of his faith. And I wanted to read a portion from Luke 21, the Jesus Movement Story, Volume 1. You're in Volume 2, of course, here in Acts. But in Luke 21, just let me remind you of Jesus' words to the apostles when Jesus was telling them about the difficult days to come. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, he told them. And there will be earthquakes and in various places plagues and famines, and there will be terrors and great signs from heaven. But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and will persecute you and deliver you to the synagogues and prisons, bringing you before kings and governors for my name's sake, and it will lead to an opportunity for your testimony. So make up your minds not to prepare beforehand to defend yourselves, for I will give you utterance and wisdom which none of your opponents will be able to resist or refute. But you will be betrayed, even by parents and brothers and relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death. You will be hated by all because of my name. Yet not a hair of your head will perish, and by your endurance you will gain your souls or gain your lives. All of this he tells the apostles about the days which are just ahead of them. We tend to read, sometimes people read those verses and go, oh, that's somewhere way off in the distant future. But then Jesus says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. So this is all about first century Christians and the fact that they're going to be have persecution which is going to arise from within their own communities and within their own families, and then from the Romans as well. What are they supposed to do with this? Well, Jesus says in verse 13, realize that when you show up before kings and so on, it's an opportunity. And, of course, I hope that's one of the things we've been picking up from Paul, is that even when he's standing there with chains around his wrists and his feet, he goes, I feel like this is an open door. And that's a remarkable thing about our friend here, this great example to us. So, over in chapter 22, we remember that Paul now has been rescued by the Romans from a mob riot in Jerusalem, which has broken out. And why was it that this riot's broken out in Jerusalem? Paul's in the temple, and what does everybody, what do his contemporaries think has happened? What's he done? Brought a Gentile, that one of those Ephesian fellows, into the temple with him, which was not the case. But having identified Trophimus with him earlier in the week, they thought somehow seeing Paul in the temple, well, he must have been with him, which was not the case. Well, this riot breaks out. Paul is going to be killed, but is rescued by the Roman garrison. In chapter 22, then, verse 1 through 29, we have Paul's testimony to the crowd. Now, we've already looked at much of this because of our look at Paul's conversion back in chapter 9. And we looked at some of these passages with regard to the different ways in which Paul explains what happened to him on that day. But I want to draw your attention this morning to a little word in 22 verse 1. Brethren and fathers, hear my defense, which I now offer to you. And that it's that word defense, and or apologia. It's where we get our word apologetics. Now, when we hear the word apology, it's where we get our word apology. We think only today of saying what? I'm sorry, mea culpa, you know, perhaps mea maxima culpa. really bad, you know, on my part. But the ancient sense of an apologia, an apology, was to offer a reason, a defense for what you believe. And so he stands up before the crowd and he says, I'm going to offer you my apologia, my defense. And he's speaking to them in the Hebrew dialect. And if you go through this speech, you'll find if you look down here in letter B, we'll go back to 1 Peter 3 in just a moment, but just the essentials here. Paul does this in his apologia, and I think this is a good model for us to follow. First of all, he begins with himself And he seeks to identify himself with the people to whom he is speaking. I'm one of you. Now remember, he's just spoken to the Roman garrison leader in what language? He spoke to him in Greek, all right, common currency language there of the time. But when he turns to this crowd that are the mob of Jerusalem, he begins to speak to them how? In Hebrew. And so he's identifying linguistically with them, having already done that with the Roman, and now he's doing this with the people, and he essentially says, I'm one of you. Now he does that linguistically. He says, I'm a Jew. That's what I am. I'm a Jew born in Tarsus of Cilicia, brought up in this city. I went to school with you people. We all know each other here. And I was under Gamaliel, who was the most renowned rabbinical teacher on the Sanhedrin at the time. And I was brought up strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you all are today. So what does he do? Does he say, you bunch of rascals? No, he says, I understand why you're beating the living daylights out of me. You're zealous for God. I appreciate that. Now see, most of us, having been beaten near to death, would not say to somebody, that was excellent. I really appreciate the way you went about that. That was a really good, strong, right uppercut there. And and I know why you did that. You did that because you love the Lord, and thank you. That's just not how most of us would begin this speech. But Paul is so intent on identifying with these people that he begins by making sure that he has built a bridge with them. One of the things that has to happen in public speaking, those of you who've taught that or studied it, is not only does a bridge have to be built from the text or the subject to the audience, there has to also be a communication bridge between the presenter and the audience. Because if that bridge doesn't get built between presenter and listener, then the information that's in the text can't move to the people who hear as well. So Paul is identifying with them. And so he's telling his story. But in all stories, of course, from Christians, there's a place in the story that says, but Jesus. It's not just about us. Okay, so we're revealing who we are. There's a sense of autobiographical testimony here. But in all testimonies, we come to the Jesus place. In verse 6, but it happened that while I was on my way, a very bright light came to me. So there's the but Jesus moment in the story. And then following that, there is this issue of new life, which involves commission. The but Jesus moment is conversion. And the new life involves a new vocation, a new calling, a new commission. So conversion and commission are part of the story. Verse 10, what shall I do, Lord? And so Jesus begins to give him directions. Now there's a brief autobiographical detail here in verses 17 through 21 that doesn't show up in earlier accounts of Paul's conversion. And I wanted us just to note that. It happened when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple. Okay, so after his conversion and Jesus has appeared to him and said, I'm going to use you, you're a chosen instrument of mine, he's been baptized. Remember, in Acts 9 he comes back to Jerusalem, and that was when the apostles didn't want to see him. Remember, who takes him under wing? Right, Barnabas, remember? But there's real fear about associating with this fellow, Saul of Tarsus, Paul. And while he's in Jerusalem, he begins to preach, and then finally a lot of trouble breaks out there in Jerusalem in his first episode of ministry there, and they pack him off to Tarsus, where he goes and spends some time. But before he leaves, this is a little bit of what happens to him in Jerusalem in private. This is the first time we get a glimpse of this during Paul's first visit to Jerusalem after his conversion. It happened when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying where? In the temple. Okay, so he's saying to them, you saw me in the temple this week. And in fact, right after I met Jesus, I came straight back to the temple. And I fell there into a trance. And I saw him, Jesus, saying to me, make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me. That explains why Paul was certainly willing to go to Tarsus when the apostles came to him and said, it's time for you to leave the city. Yeah, you know, the Lord wants me to do that. And I said, Lord, they themselves understand that in one synagogue after another, I used to imprison and beat those who believe in you. And when the blood of your witness, Stephen, was being shed, I also was standing by approving and watching out for the coats of those who were slaying him. In other words, Paul at this point is doing what with Jesus? He's arguing with him. Lord, the Lord's saying to Paul, you need to go. And Paul's saying, you know, I don't need to go, Lord. These people know me. They understand that I was a persecutor of you. They're going to really like me here. And so then he said to me, and I hope you have the exclamation point in your text, go! For I will send you far away to the Gentiles. Get out of here. This is not where your ministry is. Okay? And this is very important for us to realize when the Lord's directing us, we stop arguing with Him. And the Lord says, I want you to go. Paul could not in that moment understand. But I hope one of the lessons we've learned in Acts is that understanding comes after obedience. We want to understand and then obey. God wants us to obey, and then we'll come to understand. And so Paul goes back to Tarsus. You can imagine going, you know, back home to the city where you were born. You know, they sent you away to go to the great academy, to become the very successful person in the very important city. Now you come home. Well, what are you doing? Well, waiting on the Lord. You know. And he spends quite a bit of time before Barnabas, remember, comes to get him and brings him back to Antioch. So Paul goes through this lengthy period of isolation. And he's doing ministry there in Tarsus, that's for sure. But he's waiting for this ministry to unfold. Well, we'll come back to this account in just a moment. But let's look over at 1 Peter chapter 3 for just a second. Oh, yes.
So he wanted to go to Jerusalem, and God said, go to Tarsus, right?
In essence, he's in Jerusalem.
Okay.
He's there. He wanted to stay there. Yeah.
And God says, go to Tarsus.
Right? Go, yeah, that's right. Get on out of here.
No.
These folks, they know what I'm like. They know I was a great persecutor. They're going to think this is a great story. Well, not exactly. Now, over in 1 Peter 3, we pick up this word apologia. Okay, the apology, the apologetics. Now, and Peter gives some instruction about this. Over in verse 14, even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you're blessed. Do not fear their intimidation, and don't be troubled, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your heart, always being ready to make a defense, an apologia, to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence, and keep a good conscience, so that in the thing in which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame. Well, a couple of things here about how we speak with those who don't yet believe, how we use our apologetics. A couple of points I wanted to make. First thing is, Peter says, don't be afraid and don't be intimidated. I think one of the most easy traps for us to fall into is that we somehow think that unbelievers are a fearful or intimidating crowd. I suppose, you know, especially like living in a large university community, you go, oh, well, I'm going to run into some philosophy professor, and he's 10 times smarter than me. He's got more letters after his name than in it, and he's going to bedevil me with his rhetoric and Socratic arguments and make mincemeat out of my Christian testimony. And so Peter says, first of all, don't be afraid and don't be intimidated. Well, why? Well, the word of the cross, we know, is what? Foolishness. To those who are perishing. It's a stumbling block. But it is to those who are being saved. What? The wisdom and the power of God. We don't need to be afraid or intimidated. Y'all are good Calvinists. Well, at least if you're not, you should be. I know some people are predestined to be Arminians, but what can I do? And so you believe that the Lord has gone ahead of you and He's at work by His Spirit. Why should you be afraid to talk about Jesus to people that the Lord is at work with? As though, somehow by your cleverness, like if you could just get smart enough, you could argue Professor into the kingdom. Well, if you could argue him in, maybe somebody else could argue him out. And so, while arguments are an important aspect of our work, and evidences are an important aspect of our work, the first thing we have to settle is this. Evidences and arguments aren't what transform hearts. What transforms hearts is the work of the Holy Spirit and the grace of God. So we need not fear, and we don't need to be intimidated. That's the first thing. Secondly, Peter says, sanctify Christ as Lord in your heart. Dedicate yourself to the Lord. It's very easy, by the way, to go out into the world and be in order to win the world and be won by them. It's very easy to go out into the world to seek to win the world and end up being won over by the world. One minister I knew in his 70s said when he started his ministry, he wanted to change the world. And about halfway through, he wanted to just change his church. And then by the end, he just wanted to make sure the world didn't change him. That may be overly pessimistic, but he had encountered the reality of how powerful the forces of darkness can be in seeking to pull us away. And so if we're going to interact with the world, it's vital that we do not fear. We also keep our eyes firmly fixed on Christ. Sanctify Christ as Lord in your heart. Know what you believe. Know why you believe it. Know to whom you belong. Who has loved you so well in the cross and purchased you with His blood, so that while not being fearful or intimidated in any way, you are wholly dedicated. So no intimidation, but constant dedication to Christ. And then thirdly, he says, don't answer questions people aren't asking. Yeah, verse 15. Be ready to make your defense to everyone who asks you. I don't know if you've ever been assaulted by a well-intentioned person. I was walking across the campus at the University of Evansville, and a person came up to me and grabbed me by the shoulder and said, "Are you saved?" And of course, I had lots of fun with this. And, you know, from what? And, you know, and so, you know, I had a great time. So I let him share on. But, you know, and then he wasn't convinced I really was saved, but, you know, I don't know if I ever got him really convinced in the midst of my being convinced. But it's important for us to remember that we need to answer questions people are asking, not those questions they're not asking. When somebody asks you to share your faith with them, that is an important time to share them, rather than assaulting people. All right? If there's an opportunity, share. Take every opportunity, by all means. But also remember that we can be asking questions. Remember, Philip comes up to the Ethiopian eunuch in the chariot. He sees him reading the scripture, and he says, "Those verses right there condemn you to hell, right?" No, that's not what he says. He says, "Do you understand what you're reading?" "Well, now how could I unless somebody explains me?" "Ah, well, okay. I'll be happy to sit down with you and go over that." So it's important. Jesus comes to the Samaritan woman, and he asks her for a drink. And begins to ask her a series of questions. He's not making assertions towards her. He's asking questions of her. In the same way, we need to listen carefully to the questions our unbelieving friends are asking us and answer those questions. And be ready to do so. And if we don't know the answer, by the way, don't make something up. I'll just toss this in here for extra. If you don't know, it's not a problem to say, "You know, I have no idea. That is such a good question." You can respect the person's question and them by saying, "I don't know the answer to that question, but I'll get back to you. Would you meet me next week for coffee?" And then you can, you know, call 8 of your friends and get a Bible dictionary and figure it out. And then meet them and say, "Well, you know, let me tell you what it says." Yeah, that's what will happen. So, and that accounts for this next thing, which is with gentleness and reverence. People, again, if you're fearful and intimidated, how do you tend? What happens to your voice when you're afraid and intimidated? Yeah, you can get kind of, you know, and you get a little hostile, and the claws come out, you know. So, you demon worshiper, you know. I mean, you know, people get a little weird, and so Paul says, "I want you to answer." Peter says, "I want you to answer the unbeliever with gentleness and reverence or respect." In other words, all human beings, even unbelieving human beings, bear God's image, and so we can learn from them because all truth is God's truth, right? Right? It's all His truth, first of all, so listen carefully. But secondly, when you answer them with respect. Not yelling at them, not arguing with them in that kind of way. With gentleness and respect. With those who are asking you. That's the context here. Because we'll see something, a little different approach. And then he says, keep a good conscience. In other words, the shining light of a conscience-inspired life is your best defense. So we witness both with our lips and our lives. And obviously our lives don't always match our lips, do they? But to the extent that God is at work in us by His grace and we're seeking to follow Jesus, let's live holy lives so that our lives are an ample testimony to the grace of Jesus Christ. So that's how we approach things. Now, back to Acts 22. When we get there, Paul says, okay, Jesus told me, go away to the Gentiles. And then verse 22 of chapter 22, they listened to Paul up to that moment. And then, as soon as he said the G word, right? You know how this is going to go. Away with such a fellow from the earth. He shouldn't be allowed to live. You see, this whole aversion to the incoming of the Gentiles to the kingdom is a very, very potent and powerful thing in the Jewish mindset, especially in the post-Maccabean era, the 150 years since the Maccabean revolt, in which their relatives, these are their grandparents, great-grandparents, have been put to death for being faithful to circumcise their children, teach the Hebrew language, purge the temple. The nation was almost destroyed by the Greeks under Antiochus Epiphanes within 150 years of these events. And so when a man comes up and says, we need to go to the Greeks and we need to welcome them, they can't even begin to fathom that. Okay? So this man needs to die. So the whole thing starts up again. The Roman commander knows that where there's smoke, there's fire. He's been well trained, and so he's going to find out what the real deal is here, because he doesn't understand the theological nuances, but this guy's got to be a troublemaker, and we're going to get to the bottom of this. And he brought him in, stating that he should be, in verse 24, examined by scourging. Now, the examine, that's a Latin word, examine, the examine, and that's where we get our modern-day word examination, like a test in school. But in the ancient world, the examine was Roman flogging, which I've had algebra was that and more. I mean, the only reason I passed algebra is because I was on the basketball team growing up in Indiana. So, I mean, that's it. But in any case, the scourge, in Latin, the flagellum, some of you will know, was a fearful instrument of torture consisting of leather thongs. These are F.F. Bruce's words now. Weighted with rough pieces of metal and bone, Bruce writes, if a man did not die under the scourge, which frequently happened, he would be crippled for life. So Paul is all stretched out here, and the man is at the back with the flagellum, ready to examine Paul, which means as soon as that whip starts flying, people tend to share what's really going on. Happy to tell you, if you tell that big guy over there to calm down. And so now Paul, on the other hand, just says, I'm a Roman. At which point the Roman commander goes, really? Because if he does that to a Roman, then he's endangering his own life. And so the commander says, you're a Roman? He says, yes. He says, I acquired my citizenship with a large sum of money. Paul says, I was a born citizen. So those who were about to examine him immediately let go of him, because they themselves could have been put to death for scourging a Roman citizen. He was afraid that when he found out he was a Roman, because he put him even in chains. So, wanting to know for certain what was going on here, he decides to call the Jewish Sanhedrin Council together. Now, let's watch gentleness and respect go out the window. Remember that thing in 1 Peter 3 about gentleness and respect? Okay, answer those who ask you with gentleness and respect. Well, now Paul's not being asked, and he's going to take a slightly different approach. He's not being asked, he's being accused. Paul, looking intently at the council, said, brethren, I've lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day. So he begins with that self-identification with the group, brethren. The high priest, Ananias. Oh, wait a minute, where have we run into him before? Who's Ananias? Well, this is the very same high priest along with Caiaphas who had Jesus put on trial, right? Okay? He commanded those standing beside him to strike Paul on the mouth. And Paul said to him, God's going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Do you sit to try me according to the law and in violation of the law order me to be struck? The bystander said, do you revile God's high priest? And Paul answered, I was not aware, brethren, he was high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. This is Paul having the Jesus approach. Because Jesus was never shy about saying in religious leadership context, you're a bunch of stinking hypocrites. Remember with the adulteress, with the leper, with the quote-unquote sinners. Jesus was always welcoming, always gentle. But with those who oppressed them and who used their religious positions for personal power and gain, Jesus was unwithering in his criticism. And cursing the fig tree was a picture exactly of the leaves but no fruit that was going on in Jerusalem, and why Jesus said the entire temple complex would ultimately be destroyed by the Romans in his prophecy in Matthew 24, Luke 21, Mark 13. So Paul remembers that Jesus saying, Matthew 23, you whitewash tombs. Remember Jesus says about the Pharisees and the Sadducees in Matthew 23. You are whitewashed tombs. Paul quotes that parable of Jesus now to Ananias. On the outside, you look great. On the inside, you're full of corrupt death. You're just bones. Well, what does Paul then do? Well, he takes advantage of the situation. Perceiving that one part of the group were Sadducees and the other Pharisees. Let's stop right there. What do you remember about the Sadducees? No resurrection, no angels, none of that. Pharisees? All of that. What's Paul? Pharisee. He began crying out in the council, I'm a Pharisee and the son of Pharisees. I'm on trial for the hope of the resurrection. And as he said this, there occurred a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. Sadducees say there is no resurrection or angel or spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. So a great uproar occurs, which Paul starts. You see, he started it. And some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, there's nothing wrong with this man. Maybe a spirit or an angel has spoken to him. So, this is great. So Paul now just gets to stand back and go, he's like the little guy who walks in the bar, starts the fight, and just, you know, watches the tables start flying, you know, in the Western. So great dissension was developing. The commander, the Roman commander's there, he was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them. So he orders the troops to go down and take him away from them by force. So they do that. And then that night, the Lord did stand by Paul's side and say, take courage. As you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, you must witness at Rome also. Now, at this point, a conspiracy develops. They weren't able to succeed in bringing charges against him in the council. They weren't able to kill him as a mob. So now we've got to come up with a different plot. And this plot is that as Paul is going to be moved, they will ambush those who are transporting him, which would have been a very small number of guys. A huge mob or crowd of people could attack that very small contingent, not kill any of the Romans necessarily, but certainly take Paul away from them and kill him. Well, there were 40 men, it says in verse 13, who formed this plot. But it becomes known. And there's a little, again, little autobiographical detail here. Verse 16, the son of Paul's sister. Okay, now we don't know the name of Paul's sister. But here's Paul's nephew. He's a young fellow. Paul's sister lives in Jerusalem. We don't know whether she's a Christian. But she hears about this plot. My guess then is that she probably wasn't. Remember, Paul was what? He was a Pharisee. Okay, and he's in very high circles in Jerusalem. My guess is that his sister is probably a non-Christian Jewess, who is, like him, in very high circles in Jerusalem and catches wind of this plot to kill her brother. So she sends her little boy down where Paul is in prison, his nephew. And he told Paul about the plot. Paul called one of the centurions and said, lead this young man to the commander. He has something to report to him. So he took him to the commander and said, Paul the prisoner called me to him and asked me to lead this young man to you since he has something to tell you. So he took him by the hand. And stepping aside, now see, who would you take by the hand? You wouldn't take an 18-year-old by the hand, would you? This is a pretty young fellow here. All right, takes him by the hand. He says, what is it that you want to tell me? I think this would be a great movie scene, you see. I just think this would be a terrific stuff. You know, I haven't seen Hollywood do this one yet. This is great dramatic stuff. The commander took him by the hand and said, what is it you want to tell me? He said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the council. And as you're going, 40 of them have bound themselves to an oath not to eat or drink until they take him from you and kill him. And so the commander says, don't tell anybody that you told me. Just go on back home now. Don't tell anybody. Leave it with me. Now this is the middle of the night. So in the middle of the night, a couple of centurions say, get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night, which is about 9 p.m. And I want you to get 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. 200 soldiers, 70 men mounted on horse, and 200 spearmen. That's 470 soldiers to guard the little bald rabbi from Tarsus. Okay? I think it's one of these examples of God's super abundant, overflowing grace towards us. He will give his angels charge concerning you. It reminds me of Elisha saying, God, open the eyes of my servant. Because he sees all the soldiers, remember, lined up against him. And he says, open his eyes. And he opens his eyes and he sees the mountainside filled with fiery angels. And he says, they're more for us than against us. And so I can imagine Paul suddenly realizing, I'm getting treated pretty good here. You know, yeah, I've got these chains, but I got 470 Roman soldiers as a personal escort. I mean, I look like the president coming to town here. All right, so off I go. So he's got this tremendous Roman contingent. They were also to provide mounts to put Paul on. So Paul, of course, is a prisoner. Are most prisoners put on a horse? No, so for the journey to Caesarea, Paul himself's given a horse. And he's going to ride with the Romans to Caesarea. And the commander puts a letter to go to Felix the governor. And we have the letter. Claudius Lysias to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came up to them with the troops and rescued him. Having learned he was a Roman, wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. What's the episode that he skipped in the middle of that as he writes? I was about to beat the living daylights out of him. Stop, mention that. That's not, Paul, will you not mention it if I give you a lot of soldiers? You know, forget it. You, me. Okay, we're good. Okay. I found him to be accused over questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. So when I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you. So we'll get him out of Jerusalem, end this trouble here, we're going to send him to Caesarea. Now, if you follow along your map, Caesarea is up the road, and it's a port city, and it's as close to a Roman city in Israel as you can get. It was the chief Roman city of this part of the world. The architecture is fully Roman. And in fact, recently the port, it was a huge port city, and the Roman port itself, which is sunk now into the Mediterranean, has recently been discovered by archaeologists. And aerial photos show it under the water, the great arms, these great stone arms reaching out into what is now the ocean. It has sunk down. But I mean, this is a massive, massive, huge Roman city that Paul is now going to. And it's there where there was a palace where the governor stayed, and where, had Caesar ever visited that part of the world, he would have stayed. All right. So this is, Paul is being sent to Rome away from Rome when it comes to this part of the world. And he's being sent with a full escort on horseback with a letter to the governor. So they bring him by night to Antipatris, sort of a halfway point. Then leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they return to their barracks. And when these had come to Caesarea, see, the name of the place is named for Caesar. It's the city of Caesar. It's Caesarea. All right. They deliver the letter to the governor, and they present Paul to him. So here's the governor. Now remember, what did Jesus already say in Luke 21? We read it at the beginning. When you're in front of governors and kings, that's called what? That's an opportunity. All right? And he says, I'll give you a hearing after your accusers arrive, giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. Now, the praetorium was Herod's residence. Okay, now where was Paul in Jerusalem? Well, he's in these Roman barracks. This is a guy who's been sleeping on floors. He's out in deserts, all kinds of places. He gets to Caesarea, and where do they put him? They put him in King Herod's palace. So Paul goes, sweet, in Hebrew or something like that. You know, this is all right. Yeah. So he goes, this is good. 5 days he's in Herod's praetorium. When that Ananias comes down with the elders, their plot having been exposed and thwarted, and he brings with him a prosecuting attorney, an orator, is a rhetorician named Tertullus. Tertullus is the one who's going to bring the official charges in this trial. So Paul is summoned, and Tertullus begins to accuse him before the governor. And he begins, of course, as all good rhetoricians do, with praise for the most excellent Felix, with praise for the governor. We know that you're great, and you've been doing wonderful things for our people. Sorry to bother you with all this, but in verse 5, this man is a real pest. And he stirs up dissension among the Jews throughout the whole world. He's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, and even tried to desecrate the people. And we arrested him. But your commander came along and with violence took him out of our hands, ordering his accusers to come before you. Now, if you examine him, you'll be able to see that the things we're accusing of him are true. And the Jews who'd come with him brought this attack. When the governor had nodded for him to speak, Paul responded. Well, I want to just stop here for a little moment and remind us that in some courtroom language. One of the things that Paul, of course, does in Romans is he uses marketplace language, words like redemption. And he uses family language with words like reconciliation. And he uses law court language with words like justification. And he says in Romans 8, for instance, who will bring a charge against God's elect? So here he is on trial in this Roman court, and here is Tertullus, the rhetorician, his accuser. Now, the Hebrew word for what Tertullus is doing is Satan. That's the Hebrew word. Our name, Satan, is actually a word that means adversary. And it's a legal term. It's a courtroom term. It's the person in the courtroom who is saying, you're guilty. You have done this. That is the Satan, the adversary, the legal adversary bringing charges. And so when I read Romans 8, and I hear Paul say in Romans 8, who can bring a charge against God's elect? I can very easily imagine him thinking through this kind of episode and going, you know, this man can't succeed. After all, if God is, what's he say in Romans 8? For us, who can be against us? Who can bring a charge against God's elect? Christ is one who died, yea, rather who is risen, who is at the right hand of the Father, whoever lives to make intercession for us. So Paul's not afraid of any of these accusations. Neither should you be. There is therefore now no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus. When the enemy wants to bring accusations against you, when your Satan appears to bring accusations against you, well, you need to rest in the knowledge that Christ's blood has been shed and you have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. You're justified by faith. Be at rest. Be at peace. So how does Paul respond, you see, to Satan? Just to kind of put this in some kind of context. Well, the charges against him are that he's a troublemaker and that he was a heretic. That's the word that Tertullus uses. In Greek, he calls him a heretic. The ringleader of the sect, the heresy of the Nazarenes. And that he was desecrating the temple. Well, what happens? Paul says, knowing that for many years you've been a judge to the nation, I cheerfully make my defense. Here's his apologia again. Okay? You can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. Neither in the temple, nor in the synagogues, nor in the city itself did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or causing a riot, nor can they prove to you the charges of which they now accuse me. But this I admit to you, that according to the way, which they call a heresy, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law and what is written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men themselves cherish, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. In view of this, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience before God and before men. Now, after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings, for which they found me occupied in the temple, having been purified, without any crowd or uproar, but there were some Jews from Asia. Right, that's off. Remember Ephesus and all those places. That's how the whole thing arose. Who ought to have been present before you and to make accusation if they have anything against me, or else let these men themselves tell what misdeed they found when I stood before the council. Other than for this one statement, which I shouted out while standing among them, for the resurrection of the dead, I'm on trial for you today. Felix, having a more excellent knowledge about the way, put them off, saying, when Lysias, the commander, comes down, I'll decide your case. In other words, let's get that commander down from Jerusalem. I want to hear first-hand testimony about what went down, and I want to hear it from the Roman who was in command. Then he gave orders for the centurion, for him to be kept in custody, and yet to have some freedom, and not to prevent any of his friends from coming and ministering to him. Now, Felix is going to arrive with Drusilla, who was a Jewess, sent for Paul. And as Paul was discussing righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix became frightened and said, go away. And when I find time, I'll summon you. So he was hoping that money would be given him by Paul. Therefore, he used to send for him quite often and converse with him. But after 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and wishing to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison. So how long is Paul being held now in Caesarea? 2 years. See, we just read through this brief chunk, and we got to realize 2 years go by.
So they moved him out of the palace.
They move him out of the palace, and he's being held in the garrison. But he has freedom. He can walk around in there, and who can come and talk with him? Friends, relatives, maybe Paul's sister from Jerusalem comes up, brings him a bundt cake. I don't know. But there's all kinds of things going on here. And no doubt, Paul's walking around with all these Roman soldiers and looking at shields and helmets and swords, and that'll come up later. And in his letters, right? He's learning from the Romans and sharing with the Romans and so on as he walks around and has this freedom. There's an important word here that I don't want you to miss, and it's the secular usage of the term. Sometimes the secular usage of a term is helpful for us to understand. Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and wishing to do the Jews a favor. Now, what's a favor? If you ask somebody to do you a favor, why is it that you ask them to do you a favor? What is that? You're asking someone to what? Do something that you can't do. And maybe you can't do it because, well, I don't have the time to do it, or I don't have the ability to do it. I don't have the resources to do it. I'm mechanically dyslexic. You know, I mean, even with directions. Tony remembers she's just nodding like, oh, yes, help him, Lord. I mean, the very first hose reel I ever brought home from a Lowe's or something 20 years ago or whatever, I put it together backwards. It was facing out. I mean, and I had directions and everything. And they were in English. I'm better now. I'm better now. But, I mean, if you ever do see me coming with a tool belt, you know, I mean, just run. But in any case, I mean, I am better now. I'm better now, yeah. I mean, I don't use a hammer for everything. But there are certain things I run into where I call somebody to help me. I said, could you do me a favor? Because what? I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm looking at the same thing. He'll be looking at it, but he can read it, and I can't. I have no idea what's going on here. A favor is when someone does something for you that you cannot do for yourself. And the Greek word for favor is charis. C-H-A-R-I-S. Grace. What is grace? Well, see, it's when God does for us what we cannot do for ourselves. We are saved by, which means we cannot save ourselves, and so God saves us. All right? So when we talk about grace, grace, you see, is one of these religious words. Okay? And so because words get used religiously, we tend to kind of give them religious definitions and file them away over here to a religious corner. And sometimes that reduces their meaning rather than amplifying their meaning. So I want us to remember that what it means to have grace at work in our lives is that God has come to us, not only in salvation, but in spiritual gifts and in strength, in our weakness, in all of these ways, God gives us grace. What is grace? Grace is when God comes and does for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Wishing to do us a favor, God sent Jesus. All right? So, he leaves Paul in prison. Something very important happens now in the first 12 verses of chapter 5, 25 rather. Festus, having arrived in the province, 3 days later went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. While he was there, the Jews had not forgot about Paul over these 2 years, and they said, you've got a guy back there in Caesarea we want you to put on trial. And then Festus said, Paul's being kept in custody at Caesarea. He was about to leave shortly for there. He said, so let some of your influential men come up there. If there's anything wrong about this man, let him prosecute him. After he'd spent not more than 8 or 10 days among them, he went down to Caesarea. On the next day, he took his seat in the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought in. So Paul arrives, and the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many serious accusations and charges against him, which they couldn't prove. And then Paul said in his own defense, I've committed no offense either against the law of the Jews or against the temple or against Caesar. But Festus, here's the phrase again, wishing to do the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said, are you willing to go to Jerusalem and stand trial before me on these charges? Now let's stop there for just a second. There's a very tricky question. Paul, you say you haven't done anything wrong. Well, here are your accusers. Let's go back to Jerusalem. Now here's where Paul comes right along and he says, ah. Now see, this is one of Paul's great things. His all things to all men stuff. If Paul knows something, if he goes back to Jerusalem and he stands on trial, what's going to happen? They're going to kill him. In fact, he knows he may not even make it back there. And so what does he do? He goes, well, I'm a Roman. So guess what I can do? I can take this, buddy, all the way to Rome. You want me to go back to Jerusalem? This is great stuff. See, Paul looks at him and he goes, I'm going over your head. I think Festus thought he had Paul in a corner. And Paul said, I'm standing before Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried. I have done no wrong to the Jews, as you yourself very well know. If then I'm a wrongdoer, I've committed anything worthy of death, I don't refuse to die. But if none of those things is true of which these men accuse me, no one can hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar. And when Festus had conferred with his council, he said, you've appealed to Caesar? To Caesar you shall go. So Paul is now going to get an all-expense-paid trip to Rome, where he now will appear in his own mind before who? Caesar, who now, at this point, is Nero. Yeah. And so Paul, in his opinion, is going, Jesus said, kings, governors, I'm going to go in front of Caesar. Yeah, I'm going as a prisoner, but when I get there, I'm going to be able to preach directly to Caesar. And when I do, maybe Caesar himself will be converted. Right? So see, he's thrilled about this opportunity. Okay. What's the chief lesson in all of this? Well, the first thing that I'd point out to you today is that God, that the plans of God cannot be stopped by the plots of man. When Jesus wants us to go, man can't stop you going. He can't ultimately hinder your appointed destination. Remember, Paul wants to get to Rome, doesn't he? And he writes to the Romans, I want to get there, and after I come to you, then where am I going? Spain. Paul has every belief that when he gets to Rome, he'll go through this trial, and Caesar will go, there's nothing wrong with this man, let him go. And then Paul goes, glory, glory, preach to the church in Rome, take an offering, and off he goes to Spain. That's really the way he's approaching this. And he's expecting God to undertake for him in these situations. The second lesson is that we have to take full advantage of the experiences that providentially are given to us by God so that we can in every way possible identify with those we serve in the gospel and use to the utmost the resources presented to us by those who love us and oppose us. Sometimes the greatest gifts you will be given by God come through the hands of your opponents. Your enemies will often help you serve God faster than your friends. Your enemies will kick you out of a place or out of a situation that makes you go right into God's will for your life. Now, if you remember then that God uses both your friends and your opponents, and by their hands, through both, gives you gifts, sweet mercies and hard mercies. But if we remember that through both we receive gifts, because God is over all, then we'll be much more able to deal with things like unforgiveness and bitterness. And we'll see in all of our situations the hand of the Lord. And we'll be going, well, how can I share with these people? What advantage can I take of this situation now to make Jesus known? So now here in chapter 25, Paul is going to be on his way to Rome. He's got a couple of stops to make. He's going to preach to Agrippa and so on. And then we'll get him on to Rome in chapter 27 and see what his ministry is like there in 27 and 28. But the journey to Rome is an extraordinary one in which there are many, many adventures. Paul becomes kind of like a Homeric figure, an Odyssey figure, on his way past Cyclops and all of the enemies so that he can get ultimately to his destination to make Jesus known in Caesar's household. All right, well, we'll stop there and see what questions we have.